So this is the first time I'm giving a talk with a PowerPoint presentation without animation. So actually, I'm not a great fan of PowerPoint presentations, and certainly not without animations or anything special features. But I only have half an hour, so I decided that it's probably the best to do. So at least I put a pleasant background, so you can sort of relax. So basically, the general question I'm looking at is that if given a propositional proof system, then what is interesting is to investigate the proof complexity of what happens when if you have a uniform sequence of tautologies. What happens to that complexity when the size of the tautologies tends to infinity? So in some cases, you don't really want to look at all tautologies, maybe at all propositions that arise from predicate logic, but you look at some subclass. I'll come back to that later. But the point is basically in this way of looking at it that you start off with some proposition from predicate logic. That proposition could be, for example, the pigeonhole principle, but it could also be some other first order formula. And then you are basically translating that proposition into a statement that says that there's no model of the formula of size n. That's one way of looking at it. So it becomes a. So using that method, I mean, the way one traditionally is doing it is by taking the Paris-Wilke translation. So what you do is that you take your formula, it could be for bounded arithmetic or something, you take your formula and then you convert it into this sequence of tautologies. But it turns out that many nice theorems for weak propositional proof systems, you somehow need to do a slightly different translation, otherwise you simply don't get the results. So this other translation I published in a paper together with Nirositaram. So let's call it the RS translation, but I mean, RS could also stand for radical symmetrical translation or something. It doesn't have to be our name, so it's not like I'm not trying to. Or you can just view it as a special type of Wilke, Paris-Wilke translation. But let me try to sort of explain how it works. So you all know the Paris-Wilke translation. It has already been explained by a couple of speakers. So, in the Wilke translation, if you start off with a formula, and here there's some limits in the signs available. So this is an extension quantifier we have there. Do I have something to point?
Yeah,
there's a sticker.
There's a sticker. There's a blackboard.
It's this kind of old-fashioned. Yes. So this is an existential quantifier. So if you take the Paris-Wilke translation of this formula. Basically, what we're doing is that we the first bit is just basically being converted into a 0 or 1 depending on the value of n. So basically, if n is an odd number, then this part of the formula is obviously evaluated to false. And the part you keep is the part that contains the undefined relation symbols and function symbols and so on. So the point is that in this translation, you want to avoid that, because for some of the results, I'll come back to that, but the point is that the translations I'm looking at, I can explain here. So in this Paris-Wilke translation, you have something like this, equals n, and you have some other formula here. So we have something like this. Oh, I think it's not sharp. Okay. The point is that in this translation, we introduce Skolem functions for the different quantifiers and so on. So in this case, we will basically get something on this form, and then we will get the other formula here. But this thing we have to interpret also, these are also like treated like constants. So in this translation, They are simply both a plus, and also these constants are not interpreted. So the plus doesn't have any. There's no built-in ordering. There's no built-in plus. It's just treated like any other relation symbols in the translation. So I'm not saying too much more about it because it's already been published in a number of papers a number of years ago. So this I just want to explain why in a little while you will see some of the results would not be valid if we use the Paris-Wilkie translation. Okay, so the idea is if we look at this weak proposition system and then we want to let's denote by C of n the length of the shortest proof of your tautology. And the question is what kind of complexity functions can occur for this shortest proof? Well, here are some older results. For example, if you look at a very simple proof system called tree resolution, basically what happens is that the complexity function is either bounded by some fixed polynomial or it is exponential. There are these two possibilities. And which case you're in actually depends on your first order formula you started off with. If it fails in some infinite model, it's exponential. And if it's valid in all infinite models, then it's polynomial. So you have this complete characterization. But actually, I conjecture, and this is a conjecture developed together with Stefan Danchev, that a more interesting result is even valid. That actually you have three different possibilities. That basically either the complexity is polynomial, it's exponential, but again, where is this? No, here, yes. So either it's polynomial, or it's exponential in that sense here that is bound by some, in this sense, or it's actually bigger than 2 to the n log n, basically. Then now you might ask, how is that possible? But you have to keep in mind also that n here is the size of the underlying model. It's not the number of variables you have. So it's slightly different. If you're looking at all these interpreted first order formula saying that there's no model of size n of your formula. So for the pigeonhole principle, n would be the n appearing in the pigeonhole principle. It would not be the number of clauses you have. But basically the conjecture is that you have these three different possibilities. But there's another type of problem which is not, I don't know the answer to, but that is if you look at just the complexity itself as a function of n. And that was one of the things I will mention in this talk, what my talk is about, that function, it cannot fluctuate or be any function of polynomial growth. There are a lot of extra constraints on these complexity functions because that's, I'll come back to that in a few moments. Well, here's another result for resolution, for full resolution. And that is if you basically also have a complexity gap for full resolution, and it's, but in this case, you can see that you're not taking an arbitrary first-order formula. You're basically taking a first-order formula, but relativized. So the statement essentially is formalizing the fact that your first-order formula is valid not only for models of size n, but for any there's a unary predicate appearing in the formula. So basically the formula is saying that it's not only valid for the model itself, but it's valid for any subset you choose, The formula is valid when you restrict quantifiers, restrict things to that substructure. In that case, we showed that there, again, as this dichotomy, either you have polynomial growth rate or you have full exponential growth rate for that class of first order formulas. And the conjecture is that if you drop the condition about relativizing, that you still have the dichotomy. I mean, you still have polynomial versus exponential, but that has not been proved. This is a conjecture. But now let me get into some more recent results or new results. So we consider a uniform sequence of propositional formula, and let's consider the case where we don't assume that all of them actually are valid. I mean, you often, sometimes people would assume that your sequence really generates a sequence that is valid for all values of n. But some principles, like the parity principle, for example, is only valid for the even numbers and so on. So you have different principles. So for example, let's say S 2 is simply all the natural numbers for which your formula is 2, and the fault is all the numbers for which it's false. And of course, n is the size of the underlying model. So I'm looking at bounded depth Frege proofs. Maybe I should call it bounded depth LK proof or something. I think this maybe is a misnomer, that notation Frege proof. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, that's what we call it. But I think historically it's probably not correct. But anyway, that's a so here is the theorem. So we're looking at bounded depth Frege proof now. So assume that you have a proposition that fails for infinitely many values of n, but also is valid for infinitely many values. Then the theorem says that then there is then there is an infinite set n prime of numbers in the true set here, such that basically your sequence is hard on that set. That's what it's saying. Not only is it hard on that set, it's hard for any infinite subset you find. You cannot find an easy subset. So basically that's what it's saying. So any, it requires for any constant d, the depths of, it requires what do you call it, exponential size depths d Frege proofs. And there is a slightly related theorem, and it's saying again you're looking at something that also fails for some values of s, some values of natural numbers. But assume now, for example, that the set where it fails is not too sparse, so we have some identity like this. So it's not a very, it fails, but it sort of fails in regular intervals, if you want. For example, the parity principle definitely fall into that category because it fails quite frequently. So then basically you can say something slightly stronger than from before. You can say that you can actually find for any depth d, your sequence of tautologies actually require exponential size depth d Frege proof for any infinite subset of the true formula. So there's no not even easy instances. So for example, you have some corollaries for this. So for example, you can almost make them up from top of your head, because you just let's for example look at one here. I mean, so there's no field structure on the universe when n is not a prime power. That is hard. I mean, because it fails. If n is a prime power, there is a field structure on your model. But on the other hand, if you pick prime powers, because the set of prime powers is an infinite set according to the first theorem, this statement here is hard for at least for an infinite set. It doesn't say it's hard for all n's, but it's hard for an infinite set. And the same here, let's take this one for example. There's no tree regular graph G on a set n, where if n is odd. So this will again be an example. Maybe I will not really go into details of this proof, but because this is something that follows from, you can say, known methods by some work, but it's not given what has already been published, I wouldn't say it's very hard. Because basically, maybe I'll sketch the basic idea here before I go on to something more interesting. So the idea in the proof, let me go back to the theorem A, for example. Okay? So I'll give a very, very brief outline of the ideas. But the idea is that you look at some non-standard model M. So here we have the standard number, and we pick a non-standard number, a model M. And we can, because of the assumption that it fails for infinitely many and also holds for infinitely many values, we can find two consecutive numbers, N and N plus 1, non-standard numbers, such that for N, the number N, we have our tautology phi N is valid, and for N plus 1, it fails. Phi N plus 1 fails. And then the point is, if fails, that means that there is a falsifying assignment. So here we have a falsifying truth table assignment. And that's of course something that exists in the model itself. So there is simply a very specific definable way of falsifying that formula. Now suppose if you had a short proof, a sub-exponential size proof of phi n. This is an assumption, so suppose you had such a sequence here, phi m, and phi m would be a proof of psi n, okay, and let's say m is sub-exponential. Okay, so then the idea is the following. Well, as a start, let's pick a map F, a bijection that maps n plus 1 to n bijection. Of course, there exist such bijections because we're talking about an infinite set, and so we can always find a bijection from n plus 1 to n to all the. So let's start with just taking such a bijection and then see what happens. The point is that because we're looking at bounded depth formulas, you can use your bijection. And using the definable falsifying assignment to map it onto an assignment that makes sense for each of the formulas in this proof. So for each of those formulas in your original proofs, you get something called, if the falsifying assignment is called rho, for example, then it will be, you will get some assignment here, m f of rho. And certainly, the axioms in the beginning, that's the point. And here, of course, we're not using the Paris-Wilkie translation, because if you did that, you can easily come up with counterexamples to this. You have to make sure that your axioms... It's not enough that your axioms are closed under the symmetric group, by the way, because the Paris-Wilkie translation will also often result in things that are closed under the symmetric group in some sense, because, for example, false is closed under the symmetric group and so on. But you can still construct situations where you can even construct by the... If you don't have any undefined relation symbols, for example, the Paris-Wilkie could allow you to define a sequence of zeros and ones simply. For all even numbers, you would have a one, and for all false numbers, you had a zero, and that would be closed under the symmetric group. So that is not enough that it's closed under the symmetric group. I mean, you have to look into this. But the point is that here, in this case, the axioms are satisfied by applying this one-to-one map. And furthermore, the conclusion, then they evaluate to true. On the other hand, the conclusion evaluates to false. Now, okay, the problem, of course, with this construction, as you can see, is that just by picking an arbitrary bijection from n plus 1 to n, is that doesn't give you any contradiction whatsoever. To get a contradiction, you really need to pinpoint a specific point in the proof where one formula evaluates to true and the next one evaluates to false. Otherwise, you don't have a contradiction. And that's exactly what this ITIE construction, forcing construction, can give you. Well, it can give you that, provided that the proof is not too long. If the proof has exponential lengths, it will break down the construction. But if it's sub-exponential, you can find a generic map F that basically forces enough induction to hold in the model, so there will be a first place in the proof where it fails. So that's really the idea. So this is just a brief outline. So this means we have all these kind of corollaries for bounded depth Frege. But here's a conjecture that I think is interesting, and you can both state the conjecture for resolution, but also for bounded depth Frege, for example. So suppose that you have one value of n for which you have an instance of n for which it's simply hard to find there's no short proof for that value of n. It's a hard instance. For this kind of argument we have just seen, it seems natural to assume somehow or expect maybe that if you take values of m that are not too far away from n, then that also makes the instances hard when you're close to that. Because certainly we know that if instead of hard here we have impossible, so if there is no proof here, we know that this force is to be large. So the question is, if it just is large, maybe again by applying the pigeonhole principle or something, one can kind of if you think about it like a prove adversary game, then basically the adversary can use that bijection in some clever way to make it hard for the prover. So but this is a conjecture, but the point is basically that what I suggest is that this function CFN actually is quite smooth without big local jumps when n increase. So that's one thing to look at. And actually there is some special case I have settled along those that philosophy I just mentioned. So if you look at null set and sets proofs over a field of characteristic Q, then what I've shown is that if you have a uniform sequence of polynomial equations, then basically there are four different things that can happen. You can either have let's look at the degree and not the size of the. If you want to look at the size, you can represent polynomials in a sense where each polynomial, all coefficients in front of monomials is represented, even if they are zero, for example, as long as they are smaller or equal to the leading term. In that case, constant bounded when the degree is bounded by a constant, it's like polynomial size. And this one, there is a function here appearing. This is a function in if you want, where at the moment I'm actually close in proving that it's n half, but I'm working. This is something in progress, basically. So I have this bound. This is a universal function L. So I would not, for this talk, I will not exactly specify what it is, but I'll just say that it's in that function. It's universal in the sense that it doesn't depend on a specific sequence of you're given. So then there are three cases. The first case is that it's basically, you can say, polynomial. The second case is that it's exponential for all values of n, essentially behave. It doesn't fluctuate or anything like that. It's just basically exponential, bounded from below by some exponential expression. The third possibility is that basically there exists a constant C such that the residue class of n mod the characteristics of the field to the power C determine which case you're in. So either you basically it splits the natural numbers into two sets, one for which the problem is easy and one for which it's hard. And then the final, and that is an interesting case because that is when the D can have a fluctuating complexity that fluctuates in a very specific pattern. It's very restrictive. It's not like very few functions can really represent the fluctuations, but it basically fluctuates. But it's doing it in such a way that it's going between polynomial and exponential in a way where it basically depends on the, if you look at the prime factorization of n and look at the power which q appear in n, it depends, it's related to that number. So here is a concrete example of a fluctuating complexity. It's not an empty possibility. So if you, for example, consider, well, here you have some equations, polynomial equations, they're closed under the symmetric group, but they're also generated in a uniform manner. And this is basically formalizing the idea that there's no bijection between n to 2n. You can actually, this statement, there's no bijection from n to 2n, can actually be written down as just four equations. I'm not going too much into details here. But the point is that because I want to subscribe, I mean, I'm constrained in some sense by the ideology that I want to stick to one parameter, namely n here. I don't want to have two parameters in the picture. So that's why I have two different variables, one x and one y, taking care of different parts of the numbers from n to 2n. But anyway, the point is that for this system of equations, the complexity is fluctuating. You can find the infinite set. Basically, the complexity depends basically on this number here, the power of q that appears in the prime power, the exponent of the of q in the prime factorization of the number n here. So you have this kind of possibility. Of course, half an hour is far too short time to even indicate the proof, really. But it's using, maybe I should say that it's a, just a moment, I'll just get to, I have some references here. And it's very much based on ideas going back to what Eiter did in the representation theory of the symmetric group, but also a continuation, I would say, on something Krychek did. Both in that paper but also in a number of other papers. But it uses a lot of representation theory of the symmetric group. And it's actually very nice, and so lots of result comes out of this. Has nothing to do with proof complexity, but are just actually interesting in their own right. You know, there are a lot of interesting results. So. But anyway, for this talk, you can say the summary is that, sort of to summarize it, is that for weak propositional proof systems, if you are given a uniform sequence of tautologies, then basically the complexity function behaves in sort of a quite a regular fashion. What about for stronger propositional proof systems? Well, of course, here it's much more difficult to say because we don't know, for example, even for Frege, it might be that the complexity function C of n is always given by a polynomial or bounded by a polynomial. But now I'll get to somehow what made the title, because the point is that if you look at the complexity, we have this clear intuitive notion that you have some proofs are like uniform in the sense that they're naturally generalized to other values of n, and actually most situations you think of for when your formulas arrive from a first order formula, it looks like when you have one proof, I mean for example Sandbos, if you look at his proof for the pigeonhole principle in Frege, of course it's different proofs from different ends, but somehow the underlying idea is sort of a generalization, goes from one end to the next end. So basically, this is a very informal concept. Unfortunately, you say probably some of you get a bit disappointed, but a sporadic proof I'm using here, just basically there are two things that have to be satisfied, I mean, for it to qualify intuitively to be what we call a sporadic. One is that it's sort of, it's not a part of a uniform sequence. It's not like you can generate, you cannot find a uniform sequence that generalized and you can just say this is an instance of that sequence. But we want more than that, because you also want somehow your sporadic proof to actually be a good proof, not just some kind of junk. So you want it, because otherwise there are too many of them. So you basically, the point is that basically your sporadic proof should really be better, in some sense, or shorter than the uniform proofs. But because now we are looking at defining the sequences in this way, you can really talk about a specific proof being sporadic in some sense, I mean, because it makes sense. It's not just some asymptotic property or anything like that. You can simply go in and say this proof is sporadic because there is no way you can generalize this proof along, and then you can, of course, you have to be precise exactly how you generalize proof, what kind of, and then you have to look in maybe into upper bounds. It's very interesting to look at all the kind of techniques people have developed to prove upper bounds for proof. You see there are certain types of constructions, so, and they also tend to give uniform sequences. So if you take your sporadic proof and then so what I claim is that actually all the systems we have seen have this feature that it's simply not possible to have a high density of sporadic proofs. Okay? So actually all these systems, the weak systems I analyzed, you know, certainly there was only a finite number of sporadic proofs. I mean, it's very clear that you could not have anything more. I mean, that was basically what it shows. But the question is, you can state something like something that vaguely is like a crisis conjecture. You know, a crisis conjecture is saying that if you have short proofs, actually proofs with a number of proof lines bound by some constant of some statement A of n in Peano's arithmetic, then according to Kreisel's conjecture, this fact that you have many short proofs, I mean have many constant length proofs, actually means that Peano's arithmetic proves universal statement. Oh, there should of course be an x there, okay. So now the Kreisel-like conjecture you can state for propositional proof complexity is that if you have a uniform sequence of tautologies, then basically we can and we can find short proofs for each n, I mean bound by some polynomial, then actually the correspondent sentence is provable in some system for bounded arithmetic. And also we have here, if you have a uniform sequence of tautologies that have high density of short proofs, so that means that it has short proofs for many values of n, then this force, in fact, this is also part of this kind of Kreisel conjecture, then it forces a sequence to have a sequence which is actually fairly uniform for the proof. So in some sense you can say that many non-uniform proofs force uniformity. So at this stage I have to say something, because yesterday there were some people who discussed a certain construction for basically showing that you can have a situation where you have a uniform sequence that definitely doesn't have, should have a short, what to call it, have a uniform sequence of proofs. So, but the problem is that I'm already on the time, but can you give me 30 seconds maybe, or?
You're losing the discussion.
Ah, okay, yeah, okay, so. Okay, so it would be, okay, so maybe I can say that, for example, one suggestion was to look at some one-way function, f of x, and then look at some implication like this. And then the idea is that we somehow, that for each specific value of n, as soon as we have basically your witness here of this, then it's easy, you have a short proof. Now the problem with this is, in my setting, is that everything is closed under Sn. So just because we have a witness here doesn't mean, as far as I can see, that you still have to deal with the fact that you're dealing with a universal statement, that you have to consider all the built-in relations, everything you have to consider, all the different permutations of those. So the point is that if your proof system can actually prove this, it can certainly not prove it just because it can go in and verify this, because it has to verify this computation under all permutations. So your proof can actually do much more than that. It must be a different type of proof than just verifying this identity. And then you probably have a uniform proof anyway. That's my point. Because you can, of course, like you can prove that numbers are composite without having to give the numbers, you know. The fact that you prove something doesn't mean you have to find a witness for it. And if you have a non-uniform proof of this statement, then you can actually have to bear in mind that every relationship and everything there is uninterpreted, and you have to take care of all permutations. Then it's a very strong statement. It's not just something your proof system can verify easily. So anyway, that was any questions now? I think we finished now. So. Okay.